You're listening to The Dan Nichols Show.
This week on The Dan Nichols Show, what might seem like a touch of deja vu, because minus the glasses, hang on, haven't we had Maps Mapanyane on the show quite recently? Well, believe it or not, it's not actually Maps. It's somebody who annoyingly, ever since I've met him, refuses to look a day older. He is in showroom condition, and he brings with him not just an extraordinary physique, but also wonderful memories as one of South Africa's greatest ever footballers. Somebody we loved watching, and somebody we've seen a lot of now watching football himself, as we look back on a Football World Cup, but also the extraordinary story of the life and times of Max Mapanyane. Welcome, Max. Lovely
Thank
to see you,
Dan. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me, and good morning to you.
I wonder, whenever I see you, there's clearly something in the genes, because your son, Maseko, or Maps to the World, is also somebody who always looks like he's just fallen off the cover of Men's Health. But you are, without being too intrusive, in your early 60s. You look like you're in your mid-30s. How does Max Mapanyane stay as fit and strong and young as you always do?
I've been fortunate. I'm 64. I've been fortunate that I have always loved training. And I'm sure the days when I was playing, I never let go of the good habits, because I realized that you always yield good results. And I'm still doing some lifting here and there and running here and there, but it's not as hectic and extensive as in the past. But a lot of cycling also lately.
It looks like you'd come straight off the bench tomorrow if you needed to, but not playing football, certainly watching a lot of football. As we record this, there is still a World Cup final to come. By the time everybody's listening and watching, they will know whether it is Argentina or Spain who's won the final. But irrespective of the result, this was a World Cup where I think a lot of us went in with a couple of question marks, where the tickets are too expensive, people can't get into America, the teams aren't all being allowed in on equal terms, certain referees can't come in. This is not going to be a great World Cup. Well, in terms of the actual football, I'm not sure I can remember a better World Cup.
Yeah, in fact, it's been a great World Cup. And it's been a great World Cup for one simple reason. We had more African representatives, and they really pushed. But not only pushing, they taught us a lesson that a lead is not a win. And I don't know what was very so common with them, because they just never learned from each other, and they just let slip of a few leads and got to be punished later. But other than that, there are games that went to extra time. And I mean, Cape Verde, to me, they really are the big story of this World Cup. First appearance, and went on to really push Argentina to a point where you ask yourself, 3-all, what's happening here? And that, to me, was the biggest story. First appearance, and not only first appearance, but moving to the next stage.
It was one of many fabulous fairy tales during this tournament, and you've been watching them very, very closely indeed, both because you're a soccer expert, certainly, but also because you're a fan. And I think that is such an important part to include when you speak to somebody who's had a great football career, is to remember that at the heart of pretty much any athlete, there is that love of the sport, and that love of football for you has never, ever gone away.
You've never gone away. You know, it's very sad that sometimes I think, what am I doing to myself? I think you recall last Saturday when the game was at the 11 o'clock. There was an earlier game at 11 o'clock. I think it was, I'll tell you now, Belgium. Belgium was involved. And then later on, it was Argentina at 3 o'clock. And I'm asking myself, what am I doing here? 11 o'clock, I'm watching. And then I had a cup of coffee at 3:45 in the morning. And I went to bed, because that game also went to extra time. I went to bed at 5:45. On Sunday morning, I thought, I guess I love this game. It's a beautiful game, I must say.
Now, of course, these are not unusual bedtimes for a football star, but it's normally because you're falling out of a nightclub at 5:45 in the morning, not watching football with a cup of coffee.
Sorry, I didn't feel that bad because I wasn't from a club. You know?
That love of football does go back to the very, very, very beginning.
Sorry, Jen, you know, interesting you're talking about the love of football. It's funny how I just didn't shut down and say, I've played it, let me move on. Yes, I have moved on. I'm doing other things. But I don't know, there's this thing that is in me that I just would sit at 1 o'clock and now scrolling. Remember during at a normal period of time in the year, you find the different leagues. The last games ends at about 11:45. And then I'll be scrolling. And somewhere in ESPN, I'll find MLS game at 3 o'clock. And I'm thinking, what am I watching now?
It because it is so firmly in the DNA. And you're right. I will sometimes watch myself talking football. I'm a sports lover. And here, 2 in the morning, ESPN, there's a cricket match from Dallas. And you just sit there because you do love, love sport. Mm. Can you remember right back to that very, very young Max Mapognane first discovering, A, that you really loved football, and B, that you were actually quite good at it?
Very interesting that I was just doing what the township boys were doing. In fact, I grew up during the time when the biggest form and cheapest form of entertainment was just buying one soccer ball and kicking that together. But it was those plastic balls those days, and we would inflate them and kick them around. And then we would put stakes of tennis balls. That's how expensive tennis balls were. And tennis as a sport, obviously, can be expensive. So those days was even nothing that you can even think of black people playing it. And we thought this is a treasure. We would have 10 aside, you know, 10 tennis balls at stake. I'm glad it wasn't money at stake or anything. So it was just an upbringing of sort of township challenges. We would call them challenges, where we challenge each other. And it was just having fun. And that led to during a school premises or schoolyard. And from that schoolyard, you realize at lower primary, at higher primary, I remember those were the days, and I'm giving away my age. We use the intermediate story, you know, where they measure you with a stick. But I was short. And when it comes to age differences, that was, I don't know how they determined that with a stick, but I would just walk past that stick. And I would end up playing in an A team, and young as I was. And that also, I think, brought a lot of confidence in one playing, but enjoying it, not playing to want to be a professional at all.
So you're a kid growing up in the 1960s in what was a very difficult and dark time for South Africa, but clearly bringing joy to a lot of people. Here's this youngster, he's got a bit of talent. If that was today, it would be an academy. It would be perhaps joining a professional team's junior ranks and working your way up. What was the process in the late 60s, early 70s? How did the world discover you? How did you journey into professional football?
It was a very interesting setup where we would have clubs in different areas. And coming from Soweto, Meadowlands, then there would be clubs from different zones, because it's zone 1 to zone 10. And then there would be clubs from other areas, your Naledi, your Pefeni and all that. And we would face those clubs. But the interesting part of it is that we were just playing for fun. And I still commend the old men of those days where they would form a club. I started playing for a club called Submarine in 1966. And as a youngster, I would play from, we would call them EDCB. And after B, we all go and have a shower and then we watch the A team. And that's when everyone from the township just gathers around the grounds and it gets packed. And I was just feeling one day I'll play in this A team. And before I know, I was in the A team. But also, that was culminated by the fact that I was also in schools that were very good when it comes to sport. And sport in general, by the way. And it was easier for me to be discovered because I was playing both for the school and for the club. And it made it easier because some of the teammates that I was with at the club level, we were schoolmates. So the synergy was always continuing.
These were apartheid times. It was not an easy time at all for black South Africans. So how much did football give as escapism, as joy, not just to play it, mm-hmm. but to watch it for people? I'd imagine for a lot of the week, you know, life was probably not that much fun. But then you get to the weekend and, right, well, here's football. How much was football a part of? Well, here's the joy that we're able to give and we're able to have.
Football gave a lot of joy, and it wasn't really that hard because we didn't know much. You know, when you don't know better, you stick to what you know and make the best out of it. So we were just having fun. It was good life. In fact, we sitting back as adults, as we chatting from time to time, and say, I wonder if these youngsters realize that being a child and playing, it's a gift, and children are meant to play. And can't they just go out and express themselves instead of trying to be too uptight and be stuck on the gadgets and trying this, trying that? I mean, I don't even know how those things look like, you know. So they try everything. But we didn't have such things those days. And that is why I say I lived and I feel privileged to have lived in a moment where we didn't have a lot of things to experiment.
The joy that you got from football was coupled with this extraordinary talent. And yes, you finally get into these A teams that you'd once hoped of playing for. But another step entirely is to play for Kaizer Chiefs. And this was what really put Marks Mapognane on the map. When did the thought of, gee, maybe I could begin to dream of playing for Chiefs start to enter your mind? And then how did you eventually get there?
Yeah, very interesting that I never even had that dream of playing professional football. And too many people don't believe when I say I was just having fun as a youngster. And I was in an amateur team. And as we were banging in goals and winning trophies as an amateur team that was doing very well, I was told one day in a cup final, and we were leading, 9-1 at halftime. I had already scored 6 goals because I was fortunate that I could score week in and week out at amateur level. And the coach said, Mr. Mapognane, can I ask you to just step aside? Step aside for just this second half because we want to see how life will be without you. Life without me? Where am I going? Only to find that they kept a secret for me that Kaizer Chiefs have identified me and I will be moving to Kaizer Chiefs.
How old were you then?
I was 17.
Okay.
And I was still at school mm-hmm. and having fun. I said, Kaizer Chiefs? But I never thought of that because young as we were, our pastime, by the way, when we were not playing, we would just all go as a team, but not in a bus or car and all that, walk from Meadowlands out to Orlando. It's about 12 kilometers to watch the big names. I wasn't a fan of a particular team, funny enough. Never been a fan of Chiefs, Pirates, any other team you can think of. I was a fan of individuals. When I hear that Masterpieces Moripe will be at Orlando Stadium, Chiefs against Kellys, I would be there. When I know that Pinville United Brothers will be playing at Orlando, I will be there. So I was a fan of different teams because of the individuals in those teams. And I guess that's what made me to just not love a particular team, but love individuals. Oh, Aisin Tsweleng is in action. He's back from America. All those things were exciting me as a youngster.
You had the opportunity to do what so many other young footballers would have wanted, and one that could have been very, very overwhelming. We know the story worked out particularly well, but what was that first introduction like as you moved from being this superstar amateur scoring 6 goals before half-time, and now all of a sudden you're surrounded by all of these superstars, and this is your new football home?
Yeah, it was a different ball game. Firstly, I was overwrought by the occasion and thinking, wow, I'm at training with these guys that I've always been watching, not on TV. Remember, there were no TVs those days, that I've been watching from the stands. And now I've got to train with them. And the first few, I think to be precise, the first 3 months, it was too hectic. I couldn't catch up or cope with them. And I realized when you are a striker at amateur level, it's a different ball game, no pun intended, to that of professionals, because the defenders are more matured, more organized, and harder. And I thought, oh, it's harder training. I'm still not going to make this. But not like putting pressure on myself to say I'm not going to make it, but thinking I need to come up with a plan. And very interesting is that the team was patient with me because they saw potential, and they allowed me to just be myself. And in being myself, I have realized that I brought something to the team that they never had, because you always find a team that is so complete and winning trophies, and you think, what am I going to bring here? But the biggest advice I can give to any youngster is that don't get to any situation and want to be like anybody who is in that setup, because they wouldn't have had me if I was trying to be like so-and-so. So I was there and wanted to be myself, but not only myself, the best of myself, and things that I was doing at amateur. And I needed to be in the starting lineup now. It's not good enough to sign for Kaizer Chiefs and sit on the bench. And you read my CV in an interview and say, sat on the bench for 13 years. You know, that's not a good CV. So I had to be in the team. But you cannot easily substitute the likes of the late Waga, Waga de Kweb. I mean, that's one of the strikers the Chiefs had that I would marvel at from the stands. Mm-hmm. This is a man that when the goalkeeper, Peter Ballack, would throw the ball to him on a run, he would just, on his stride, volley this thing. He would do it with such ease at training. You'd think that he was using a tennis racket with his feet. And he would just hit it bottom corner, top corner. And that's the person that I had to replace. But that was his strength. Then the question becomes, what's your strength? And I came on as a sub on the 12th of April, 1981, at Lanesia. And we were playing against Leicester City. And the rest is history. Scored on my debut. And the fans started saying, who's that number seven? You know? And the interesting part of that was I never had to relax and say, I've scored for a big team and all that. I had to say, how often can I be in the starting lineup now? Because I really have been sitting on this bench and coming on as a sub. 3 months that I've just been sitting on the bench and not even coming on, not until that day. But I had to go an extra mile. In life, if you want something, you've got to go an extra mile. And the extra mile that I had to go was to get up in the morning. I wonder if you recall the days of Health and Racket Club.
I do indeed.
So before you have all these versions, so we went to, I had to go to Health and Racket Club in the morning, push weights and try to be stronger, because the defenders were coming in big sizes. I mean, Sheikhs Mashaba, the late Bully Hoko. Yeah, I mean, you look at those guys' calves and you think, how am I going to go past these guys? Brumi Dile, Jimmy Jube, you know? And we had big defenders. We had very strong, no-nonsense defenders. And I had to obviously live up to that. And by living up to that was to train, be strong, psychologically know that I can stand a contest. And I stood the contest, and before I know, that was what, 1983. That is 2 years later, 81, then 82, 83, 2 years later, I was crowned Footballer of the Year. I thought, what did I do different? But I realized that I was just scoring goals. And thanks to my youth exuberance, I could always pick up pieces in the box. When the goalkeeper drops, I would just do what Merino has been doing in the World Cup lately. So I just thought that was my strength.
When we look at football today, you'll hear this story. A youngster signs for Manchester City at £200,000 a week. Ronaldo's renewed at £500,000 a week. I'm interested to know, in 1981, as a 18, 19-year-old, what was Marx Mapognane earning to play for Kaizer Chiefs?
600 rand. You know, and that's where people don't realize.
Was that a week?
600, no. We're not working there. In fact, I even think now the guys are not still earning those per week. You know, you have to just on the site divide it by weeks, but 600 rand per month.
Per month.
Yes, you know. And the only decency about it, it wasn't in cash. It was in a check. Yeah. That's how professional the team was.
Yeah. Very, very, very different world. But one you obviously remember so fondly. And you did so well. You won Footballer of the Year, not once, but multiple times. And you caught the eyes of other people. And one of the conversations we've never had before, and we've had many, is your time in Portugal. And I'm fascinated how, at that time, given South Africa, how it worked out that a black South African was able to go and play in Portugal and how that process worked out.
Yeah, in fact, what happened is it was in 1987 when I was doing fairly well. In a year that, in the topsy-turvy year, I would put it that way, because that's the year where I broke a jaw on the 28th of February.
I remember this story well.
So I broke a jaw on the 28th of February, 28 minutes past three, at Ellis Park. We were playing against Swallows. And then I recovered after 3-4 months. And then I played against the same Swallows in my first game, in the Olsen's Cup, that is since the first game since I got injured. And that man was just next to me. But my lower jaw was still wired, or we praised.
And just for people who don't know this story, a quick reminder, this is the defender who'd been told not to let you go, and with no TV cameras, waited till the ref was at the other side of the field, turned around and just punched you on the jaw.
Yes, in fact, the ball was playing on the other side of the field, the other half, and the defender, I was told to stop me from scoring, but it wasn't told how. And then he realized that I had already scored. I was already on 7 goals in the second month of the season. And I had a plan of 27 goals to be top goal scorer, because to be top goal scorer those days was difficult, because you had the likes of Noel Cousins, you had Shane McGregor, you had Les Grobler, you had Mike Mangena, and, you know, so many players that are just out-and-out strikers. Thomas, who's fooling Hootlongwane, you know. I mean, the lady would bang them in, bicycle kicks and all that. And for you to be the best, you have to always have a plan and work on that plan. So that's what happened that year. And then, at the end of the season, if in fact towards the end of the season in October, we were playing against the Free State Stars, and I was running behind the defender, Taung, and just as he passed the ball to the keeper, his keeper, I couldn't stop on time, and I slid through. And I hit the back of his head with a full face and broke the jaw again. I was already on 18 goals, and then I went on to finish the season with 25 goals instead of the planned 27. And guess what? Noel Cousins became the top goal scorer, got the golden boot with 27 goals. I got the silver plate, which I still treasure. And because it reminds me of the pains that I've gone through that year. But funny enough, how life works is that for you to achieve, you always have to go through pains. And those pains are the ones that will make you strong. 2 weeks later, when the season closed, I got a call that I need to meet two gentlemen at Carlton Center. And I got them. They were just struggling to speak English, but could understand them. And they said, this is the request that we've got. You identified, the guys loved what they've seen on your on video. And can you come and join us in Portugal for Vitória Setúbal? Remember, youngster from the township, from the age of 6 playing football, and right up to that age of 21, my first international trip was at the age of 21, going to Portugal. And the first group of whites, remember, I was taught English at school, but the first group of white people I met never speak English. And it was such a struggle. But also, it's culminating to the apartheid and naivety of the township life. It was just a different life for me. And I just thought I'll just be here and get the ball where it belongs, in the back of the net. And they called me South African with a squeaky voice. When I just screamed because they all looked alike to me and also don't even understand the language. So I just screamed for the ball and passed them and get into space and score. So what was frustrating, though, was when it was day off, because only two people in the team could speak English, the coach and Hernanes, the captain. And when we day off, then I am on my own, you know. So I will take a stroll downtown in the park. And you know how it is, communal support, just like your Manchester. And. So the guys from Setibal would know, because I would identify it, obviously, because of my skin tone. And then they would say, "You, number 12, very good." That's it. That's the conversation I would have for the day. And frustrating it was, because I couldn't order food. I couldn't, you know, walk into the restaurant, don't know what to call what, you know. And I would just wait until the restaurant is a bit full, and then I would point at different plates for combination.
I want one of
but
those.
That's how you get strong, you know, and that also was life lessons for me.
Lucas Radebe often recalls, I think more because of the weather than anything else, but how when he started at Leeds, there was a time when he went to every single practice session with his plane ticket in his bag because he was planning to go home because he just missed South Africa so much. And at a time then, I mean, this is even before when Lucas was playing, we didn't have the internet. We didn't have this understanding of the greater world. So you're not just going to test yourself as a footballer. There's a lot of culture shock that you've got to try and get through as well.
Not only culture shock, but also life lessons. And the life lessons I'm talking about is where you have to think, what if this happens and your family doesn't even know, have an inclination of where you are. I mean, I remember when we were driving from Setúbal to Porto, I mean to Lisbon, just right in this capital. And you're thinking, it's a long drive, and at night coming back. But it's just an experience. And not only an experience, it was also something that taught one what the beauty of this game is and how other people, and put it this way, Europeans, are respecting and handling the game. I'm talking about 87. And these guys were just doing things differently to us. Differently in a sense that every time we would play, imagine we're playing a game out in Porto and on a Saturday or Sunday. But first thing in the morning, it doesn't matter it's a Saturday or Sunday. You've got to be at training a day after a hectic game. And they said, no, you don't just rest the muscles after a hectic game. You have to make sure that you deal with them, treat them nicely, and bring them down, just like what you do when after running a race. You know, you've got to always, after what, comrades or two oceans, you've got to run at least 5-10 Ks just to get the body to remember that you are going to rest. Don't worry, you know. And those are the things that one has learned at a very young age. And it was also a shock for me. I mean, training. Thanks to TV Bob that time, Bob Tatswana, they sent a crew out there watching us training. Oh, then I can tell you that from 9 o'clock in the morning until lunchtime, 12 o'clock, you're just dealing with crosses and finishing. I mean, I would be as dirty as a pig in the mud, because the goalkeepers also are saving, and then they would just pour water onto themselves, and I have to take dives and everything there. And it just becomes hectic, but it becomes your second nature. By the time I got back from there, because of the nature of training, I could jump a 2-meter hole without touching it. That's the fitness level that you get out of training at that age, and especially because one was young. And
it was obviously very rewarding. Why did it not continue? Why did you come back to South Africa?
I came back to South Africa because I thought to myself that I would have maybe a backup partner. You know how it is with the players. Sometimes you have to say, can we bring someone from South Africa to be next to this one? Just like the case in point now with Mbogazi. I mean, he's got Ditejani next to him, you know, from TS Galaxy. So someone that will make this one look more comfortable. And
it Phil Massinger with Phil Massinger
with Lucas at Leeds. Yeah. You know, that's the exact example of what I was missing. And I thought, no, I'm not going for the second season. It's the days are too long. You know, Portugal in summer. I mean, sun sets at about, what, 9:30? And you're in this country, sunset is at 9:30 in summer, and the TV is in black and white, and it's only in Portuguese. And you think, I'm just not going to cope, you know? It wasn't about the money, it was about reality. In life, you really have to say, am I living or am I chasing money? And the real thing was there was no life. That's not how a human being should live. But I guess I wasn't strong enough to hang in there.
Well, it still gave you the life lessons you spoke of. It was a wonderful experience. Mm. And it certainly made South African fans very happy to have you back home. And there was plenty more football to come when you came back to South Africa. Lots of great football. The legend, though, was already established. I do want to ask you, though, very quickly before we do wrap up, about playing for South Africa, because that was something that came later in the career for very obvious reasons, but you got to represent your country. Unsurprisingly, you got to score for your country. Was there a time when you thought you might never get to play for South Africa? And what was it like when you did run out for the very first time wearing your country's jersey?
Yeah, answering the first part of your question, yes, it was frustrating. When we were playing against each other year in and year out, and it was about, 10, 12 years for me to be playing against each other. And I thought, this doesn't work. It is just not happening. Remember, I was with Chiefs for 10 years and then Pirates for 6 years. So on the second year with Orlando Pirates, that's when we were now into the international arena. So firstly, the Continental with Orlando Pirates to play in the Champions League was a wow. Now we can face or test our strength against our counterparts in the continent. And then the international football, because they were running concurrently. And I will never forget how privileged I was to be called. I was in a sales conference with my previous employer, Adidas, in Cape Town. And then I thought they were pulling one on me when they said, during the tea break, and said, we got a message for you at the reception. And then my boss said, now there's a message that you are needed. You have to leave the conference. You are needed at OR Tambo. Bashan Mahlangu got injured at training. And that was the first official international match. We were playing the African Nations Cup qualifier against Zimbabwe in Zimbabwe. And I thought, what? And I left the same afternoon, flew to Gauteng, and then got home. First thing in the morning, I flew out to Zimbabwe, and I joined the team.
I remember watching that game.
Wow. And it was like, can't believe it's happening. And that was when Peter Ndlovu was a sensation.
The Coventry superstar.
The Coventry superstar was just all over us. They beat us 4-1. But forget about the scoreline. I know we got to be known as the 4x4 because we the week after, 2 weeks later, we went on to lose to Nigeria by 4-0 in Sehulere Stadium. And the biggest thing, though, is just to say, this is happening. This is real. And I was late in my early 30s. You know, you look at things negatively, but also with a lot of positive pride. In a sense that with the generation that I was with, I was one of the few that were privileged to play during the apartheid era and the international era. And also privileged to have played with four players and their sons. I was with one yesterday, by the way, and I said, hey, how's your dad doing? Okay, it's not doing very well, but please send my regards. And, you know, it's like, I played with this guy's dad and I played with him. You know, these things happen. But that, to me, was a big, big moment for one's career, but also for the country. Because if you ask me a question that you haven't asked, what was your best moment? The best moment was the West. Let's start with the West. The West was in 1990 when I was watching or following at the venues. I was watching the 1990 World Cup in Italy. I was all over Italy. And I'll never forget when Bremer scored that penalty, the 1-0, the only goal that won them the trophy, Germany. Bremer scored that penalty, and I was behind the poles as that ball was stuck into the bottom left. And that's when I was with the Botswana people. You know, you always go where you would be identified. So I was with the Botswana people, and when the world was in jubilation, I was in tears to say, but why can't we be part of this? I'll never forget my emotions. I said, but what? Why? Why can't the world be as one, you know? And fast forward, the best moment in my life was 1998, when not only being in the World Cup, but being part of the world. And it's a different ball game, and I want to urge people that have never been to the World Cup outside their country, forget the 2010 in South Africa. I want to urge people to just take these trips of the World Cup games, because being in France 1998, then I can tell you it was like home away from home. You know, you're stress-free, you released life, and from you bump into people that you know or don't know from PE, from anywhere in the world. But we don't meet and have fun in a different country, in Toulouse, who were just by the harbor there and everywhere. But the biggest thing is also making friends with this guy that we don't know, but he was always like this with us from Holland. This Dutch fan, we were together with him. And you just drink and have fun. And that's the beauty of it, you know. You're loose, you know. You've let the rooftop down, you know.
It's not just an extraordinary game, but it's one that has given you so much, and you in turn have given us so much as fans. And I could sit and talk to you for hours. I think we're going to have to schedule some golf together so I can just ask you more questions and live it up. But Marks, what I do want to say here is it's been a wonderful opportunity to go back in time. There will be a lot of people listening who remember the days of Marks Maponyane, but there'll also be a lot of kids who've been bored to death by their parents telling them all about Marks Maponyane. And now they've got the story firsthand of this amazing journey. And you have only just touched on a few small bits of it, so we'll have to have you back again. But for now, thank you. I'm going to get that full Marks Maponyane training regime, so I too could look as good as you when I'm 64. And thank you for the amazing memories and for always being a good friend and a great supporter, particularly of our golf day, which we look forward to having you back again later this year at.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dan. And good luck again on the golf day. It's been always fun to be at those golf days.
So there we go. Is he Maps Maponyane's dad? Is Maps Marks Maponyane's son? Well, the two will argue over it whenever you spend time with them both. Two great South Africans, but if you love Maps Maponyane, well, today's a great illustration of where that wonderful DNA comes from. A great footballer, a great man, and somebody who entertained so many people around the football world for so many years, and he's still, at the age of 64, is looking absolutely ridiculously good. My guest on the Danicle Show this week, the great Marks Maponyane.
You're listening to the Dan Nicholls Show.